BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is a download of Farming Today This Week from the BBC. The presenter today, Charlotte Smith.
Today, the impact of conflict in Ukraine on wheat and fertiliser supply.
They account for around 30% of global wheat exports, a significant chunk of corn.
The lengthy legacy of storm damage.
The big challenge for us has been also the continual number of storms we've had over the last few weeks. We just get a route opened and then it gets blocked again.
And how much do seasonal agricultural workers have to be paid?
It's completely confusing, actually, Charlotte. We've been given 6 weeks' notice on something which, on a 40-hour week, is a 38% increase on last year.
More on all that later. First, though, what you might describe as the law of unintended consequences. Farming is undergoing massive change right now, as regular listeners to this programme will be aware. We're in the process of extricating ourselves from the EU's Common Agricultural Policy. Now, under the cap, farmers got direct payments based on the amount of land they had. But to qualify for that, they had to do a bit for the environment. And on top, they could opt in to stewardship agreements, which would pay them more to do more. Agriculture is devolved, so the policy is changing in different ways in the four parts of the UK. In England, direct payments are being phased out and a new system of environmental land management schemes, or ELMs, is being introduced, where farmers can be paid for things like improving soil or planting hedges. Or they cannot join and not get paid any public money at all. And it seems some farmers are doing exactly that, leading to fears that less environmental work will be done on farms. James Peck grows combinable crops across 12,500 acres in Cambridgeshire, Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire and Lincolnshire. He's been in stewardship schemes in the past, but has no plans to join any of the environmental land management schemes.
I'm actively coming away from all environmental schemes and actually effectively all of the government schemes that they offer. We've spent all of my career, and I've got many friends who feel very similar to this, and actually the one of the things I think we want to do is to farm, and I think we want to farm without hindrance, and food production is the forefront of our mind, and that's what I want to be in farming for. Environmentally, we're proud of what we do. We don't need any government schemes to enhance the environment. And, you know, for us as an example, we've been planting 3,000 metres a year, putting new hedgerows in. It's not making fields smaller, it's just making the outsides better and creating new corridors. That hasn't been done on the back of schemes, that's been done off our own merit, because we want to have something lasting for when we go around the farm, when we're grandparents, to show our grandchildren what our contribution was to the farming.
But under these new ELMS schemes, you could be paid for what you're actually already doing in planting hedges, so why not join in?
Because at the moment I can make a decision to do something and I can just get on with it. I haven't got to employ somebody to help me with the form filling, then have inspections and then have penalisations and liabilities. And even if they want to say, oh, it's going to be a light touch, I think from my point of view, I think I've had 20 years of these type of schemes. Arable crops have gone up. You know, the schemes worked when it was £60 a tonne. When it's over £200 a tonne, actually you're basically subsidising the environment by taking land out of production, and I'd much rather have crops in the ground.
Does this mean then in a field which perhaps in the past or now has got strips around it, you know, with wild bird seed and so on, you are actually now going to farm up to the hedge?
Yes, actually for the first time in my career I've actually started ploughing those up. So I put those in with good heart and for good reason. But actually, there were a couple of antisocial issues that happened on the back of those margins. What it did was it opened up your farm to people being everywhere, which is, you know, for the environment and for wildlife, dogs off leads, etc., is just a no-no. And then we had a lot of antisocial behaviour of cars and things like that going around them. So we then reduced where those areas went, etc., to try and stop that those problems. But now, sadly, we are now ploughing those up. But I'm not sure they ever led to any great benefit. That's the one thing in agriculture which we never talk about, is measurement. We've never measured before we started these schemes or measured after these schemes. So we've never been able to actually prove that any of this creates an improvement.
James Peck. DEFRA told us these schemes will be voluntary and it will be for farmers to decide what the right combination of actions is for their particular setting. Since January, we have increased the countryside stewardship payment rates by 30%. That is on average, but they add, we hope this will be a powerful incentive for farmers to apply and the majority of existing claimants will automatically see an increase in the payments. Now, this week saw the National Farmers Union annual conference in Birmingham.
Good morning, conference. And can I say how good it feels to have everyone in this room together?
The President, Minette Batters, there opening the conference. It's been 2 years since the event last took place in person. So we were keen to hear from farmers about what's top of their agenda right now.
I think I'll probably worry about prices more than anything else. Certainly input prices and the price of fertiliser at the moment. How long we're going to have to live with inflation in agricultural input prices.
Coming from someone who's a small-scale first-generation sheep farmer, probably the thing that keeps me up at night is hoping that the wool price will pick up because it's such a fantastic product. It's such a wasted product at the minute.
One of the concerns that I have is we're planting all these trees, which I understand about for the environment, but how are we going to grow the food to feed all the world population, which is growing at an incredible rate?
Yeah, for me the most concerning is lack of government support and the direction the government want to see our industry, because they seem really determined to allow imports to come in. All they want us to do is just have trees and birds and bees on the land and import the food, which isn't good enough.
Minette Batters drew on many of those themes in her opening address, from the 200% increase in the price of some fertiliser to concerns over new trade deals and the crisis in the pig sector. She was joined on stage by the DEFRA Secretary, George Eustace, and took the opportunity to quiz him about seasonal agricultural workers. 30,000 visas have been made available for people to come to the UK to work on fruit, veg and flower farms for up to 6 months this year. But farmers are in a state of confusion because an email sent to labour providers seemed to suggest that workers will have to be paid an hourly rate of £12.31 from the 6th of April. Now, that came as something of a shock because they'd previously been told the hourly rate for seasonal workers would be £10.10. Minette Batters put the discrepancy to George Eustace in front of an audience of over 1,000 farmers.
You and I touched on it briefly out there, and you seem very surprised.
Somebody doing seasonal work might only work part-time, might work 3 days a week, might work for a month, might work for 6 months. And that is why, when you judge these things, the only viable way to do it is to look at an hourly rate. And we were also clear, and I agreed this with the Home Office at the time, that because we do want in the longer term to be able to create more employment opportunities for people in this country and to encourage more into this sector, we didn't want to undermine the labour market. And growers have repeatedly told me that they don't want access to cheap labour. They want access to labour who will do the work. So what we agreed is that the hourly rate should be set at something higher than the national living wage. And in the end, the figure that was alighted on was £10.10 per hour. So there is going to be a requirement for a minimum payment of £10.10 an hour. Having talked to a lot of growers, I didn't judge that to be in itself a particular barrier, for the simple reason that most of them tell me that the people they have working for them typically earn between £12 and £15, sometimes more, per hour at the moment. But it's got to be if it's a minimum rate, you have to set it at a realistic level, otherwise you start to have to performance manage off staff who you might otherwise be able to retain. So it's £10.10 an hour is what the agreement was. And what I'll do is take away from this, if there's been some error in the guidance, we'll obviously get that corrected.
Cue relief, maybe that £12.31 figure was a mistake. Well, producer Heather Simons has been looking into this, and I think it's fair to say, Heather, it's got a bit complicated.
Morning, Charlotte. Yes, I'm afraid you're going to have to bear with me on this one. So after that event at the conference, I contacted the Home Office, and they said that £10.10 hourly rate does still stand, and they said they didn't recognise the £12.31 figure. But they also said they stand by their guidance. Now, when you look at that guidance document, it says workers must be paid an hourly rate of at least £10.10,
but also must meet an annual salary of £25,600. So over a 6 month stay, that means workers must earn at least £12,800, regardless of how many hours they actually do in that time. So people working fewer hours will have to be paid a higher hourly rate to hit the target. Now, that's very relevant because the NFU says the average seasonal horticultural worker does 40 hours of work a week. So to hit the salary, they would have to be paid £12.31 an hour.
And that would be a big increase, 38%, in fact, on the current national living wage of £8.91 an hour.
Indeed. The national living wage is going up in April anyway to £9.50, but farmers were under the impression that they would be paying a rate of £10.10, so above the national living wage. And as you heard earlier, it seems that George Eustace thought the same. I have asked DEFRA about this apparent misunderstanding, and hopefully we'll hear more from them in the coming days.
Right, so just to get my head around this, to meet the equivalent of the annual salary required for the visa, workers would have to get £12.31 an hour for a 40-hour week. So could anyone, any horticultural worker, end up being paid the £10.10 an hour rate?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the Home Office works out the annual salary based on a 48-hour week. And if you do the sums, someone working a 48-hour week would have to be paid £10.26 an hour to hit the salary threshold. £10.10 wouldn't be enough. So as far as I can understand, that £10.10 hourly rate will only apply to workers working over 48 hours a week. The Home Office told me that rate is designed to prevent unscrupulous employers from forcing workers to work excessive hours in order to achieve that required minimum earnings.
This isn't straightforward, is it?
No, it's really complicated. In fact, mea culpa, in Thursday's programme, we got it wrong because we didn't realise that people working fewer than 48 hours a week would have to be paid a higher rate. So apologies for that. But according to the guidance, as it currently stands, that is the case.
Heather Simons there. Well, suffice it to say, farmers are worried. Ali Kappa is chair of the National Farmers Union's Horticulture and Potatoes Board.
It's completely confusing, actually, Charlotte. If the worker works 48 hours, that will be £10.26. But if it rains and I can't pick my apples and they only work 35 hours in that week, I'll be paying £14.07 per hour. And God forbid, if they only work 30 hours in a week because of the rain, I'll be paying them £16.41 an hour.
And you can't look at it as a monthly amount and adjust accordingly?
Not as I understand it, but it is very complex. We've had less than 6 weeks' notice. The Home Office are suggesting that they want to introduce this from the 6th of April. And I'm afraid that's just totally unaffordable, unworkable and undeliverable.
This is confusing because the Secretary of State at DEFRA, George Eustace, doesn't seem to agree with what the Home Office are telling you.
That's correct. He seems to think that DEFRA and the Home Office agreed a new rate of £10.10 for the seasonal workers scheme. Again, I'm not sure why we need a higher rate when the country is experiencing a cost of living crisis.
He was very clear that the government is determined that seasonal workers won't be seen as a cheap option. He says growers don't want necessarily cheap workers, they just want people who will do the work. But where does the confusion and the price increase leave you and your business?
Well, first of all, I don't know how I would feel if I was a worker working in retail or the care sector, being paid at the national living wage. And we're now discriminating against all of those workers and paying a higher wage to people who are coming in to pick fruit and veg. I don't quite understand the dynamic of that at all. Where does it leave our sector? Actually, I have had a week of incredibly anxious, very upset and often angry growers who have been ringing to say, how are we going to make this work? We can't make it work. We have already negotiated our prices with retail for this season. And we've been given 6 weeks' notice on something which, on a 40-hour week, is a 38% increase on last year. It's just completely baffling.
Mr. Eustace has said in the past that farmers should simply go to their customers and tell them they need more money.
I'd quite like him to join me in a negotiation with one of the major retailers.
What are you going to do?
I think the only thing we can do, Charlotte, is call for a delay. The industry was not consulted on this. The industry was given no notice. I don't think 6 weeks' notice on a wage increase of this magnitude is acceptable. I don't think any other industry sector would accept it. So we want delay, we want consultation, and we need input into the guidance that's written. Because what appears to have happened here is that somebody has copied and pasted the skilled worker route guidance, which is for permanent jobs in the UK, and put it into the seasonal worker guidance, which by its nature is for work where the work fluctuates day to day, week to week, and it's only for a 6 month period.
Could this mean that if you had a British based worker and somebody on the seasonal worker visa next to each other, you would be paying the seasonal worker more than the person who lives here all the time?
So in law, yes, it would be legal for me to do that. However, I have to abide by supermarket assurance schemes, and they will not allow me to discriminate between two workers who are doing the same job side by side. So what this actually will do is drive wage inflation through my whole business, through the pack house that packs my apples, and actually it will drive wage inflation through the whole of food manufacturing.
The government, though, will say they want a high wage economy. They want better and more attractive wages, particularly in agriculture, so more people will want to do it.
And my understanding was that the National Living Wage legislation was the government's policy measure for achieving that aim.
Ali Kappa. So if it's costing you more to produce food, how can farmers negotiate a better price from a retailer? David Miles is director of The Retail Mind, a consultancy that works with suppliers and manufacturers. He's also a former commercial director at Asda. He told Anna Hill that farmers shouldn't be afraid to ask for more money.
It's actually sometimes a little bit easier than you think. I always recommend that when you're going to a retailer, you're very, very clear in what you want and why you want it. And those are the things. Retailers don't have an awful lot of time to pore over decisions and do massive amounts of analysis, although sometimes they might have you believe that's the case. So you've really got to be clear yourself and understand what it is that's driving those costs, and then put that into very simple terms and then be clear. And if you're really clear and you're really confident, then that will come across and retailers will understand. They might get a bad reputation, but they're not stupid.
But then again, you know, will it work? And I'm wondering, actually, has it worked already? We've seen prices go up in the shops already. Have any farmers, do you think, actually managed to get a price rise from their retailers for the goods that they're selling them?
I think the answer to that is yes, for sure. I mean, I know anecdotally that some have, and you can see it in shops. You can see inflation in various pockets across the entire store. So in some ways, produce in particular is a much shorter lead time product area in a supermarket. So you should see, and you do see, prices coming through. So it is, you know, it's happening and it's going to happen some more.
Farmers are reluctant sometimes to ask for more because they're afraid of losing their business. Do you think retailers in Britain could turn their backs on farmers because they know they can get food cheaper from elsewhere?
Well, you know, I think that is one of the risks that this whole, in some of the dynamism in what's going on around us with Brexit, with COVID, with rampant inflation and uncertainty going forward, is if you can see an inflation that's particularly pertinent to product that's sourced in the UK. So, for example, the seasonal worker programme, that could really put to UK produce at a disadvantage. And as a retailer, it's the retailer's job to provide great product at great prices.
David Miles. The Russian invasion of Ukraine continues, and here it's already had an impact on the price of farm commodities. Grain prices are up, as are the prices of oilseeds and fuel. Russia and Ukraine provide about a third of the world's wheat exports and 15% of global vegetable oil, as well as being important fertilizer producers. Michael Every at Rabobank told me how important the two countries are in terms of global grain markets.
They account for around 30% of global wheat exports, a significant chunk of corn, sunflower oil as well. So these are not markets that you can dismiss.
Do we know yet how big the impact will be?
We don't, because we don't know how long the war will last. That's the first thing. If the war's over quickly, so there's no physical disruption to production, obviously it's more minimized. If war drags on into, you know, planting and harvest season, I mean, terrible to consider the consequences.
And I guess the first impact would be prices.
Yeah, well, physical availability would be the first thing. And then price will react to that. And to be frank, Western European countries, okay, we're going to pay a bit more for bread. Frankly, even given the inequality in the UK, which we should be always concerned about, most people are going to be able to afford that. It's emerging markets in North Africa and the Middle East that you really want to be worried about if we see physical supply disrupted for either the reasons of war and or sanctions. You're looking at hundreds of millions of people with not enough to eat. And that's a destabilizing situation we haven't had to face, well, for a very, very long time. But it's a very real threat. That is the horrible side effect that tends to happen around wars. That's why wars are so bad.
How much do we here in the UK import from places like Russia, Ukraine, Belarus? Is it an amount of wheat which we could try to replace by growing it ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Depending on what kind of price you're looking at internationally, that can happen. Look, this really isn't a threat to the UK from that particular angle. The one that's more worrying, if you're thinking more generally of food production, would be if you start to see the same impact on fertilizers, where Russia is a huge producer, so is Belarus. If they can't get those out, which is a different supply chain physically than where we're seeing fighting at the moment, that would have an impact. And then, of course, we just have energy. That will hit everybody in the pocketbooks.
Michael Every from Rabobank. Finally, after a week of violent winds and heavy rain, farmers across the UK are clearing up, and that job can take a long time. The clear-up from Storm Arwen 3 months ago is still ongoing, not least in the forests and woodlands of the northeast of England, one of the worst affected regions. It's estimated that 1 million trees fell in Northumberland alone, and many popular woodlands are still closed to the public. BBC Newcastle's Joe Lonsdale has been to Sidwood Forest, where teams of chainsaw operators continue the mammoth task of clearing miles of blocked public footpaths.
So my name's Alex McLennan, I'm from Forestry England, I'm the Recreation Public Affairs Manager for Northumberland. And we're here in Sidwood Forest, part of the larger Kielderwater and Forest Park, really popular for walkers, it's a really popular spot for red squirrels.
And if I could describe what's around us, Alex, it's just fallen trees everywhere, isn't it? But some work being done, obviously, to process them. Tell me what you've been doing at sites like this over the last 100 days.
It's a big challenge. We're picking the easy wins like Sidwood. We've got some of Lakeside Way at Kielderwater and Forest Park reopened with diversions. It's more difficult when we get into smaller woodlands such as Simonside, Thrunton, Kidland, Holystone, because actually when Storm Arwen came through, most of them were flattened in one storm, let alone all the rest of storms which had come through. So these areas need the big machines. There's only so many machines in the county. And you have to do all the planning for that work, for the habitats as well. If, for example, goshawk bird or an osprey lands in the middle of the damaged area, because then operations has to stop again. That is quite frustrating for the public. Some of these crops are highly dangerous and you can't do it with a chainsaw, to be honest with you. Machines have been double shifting, doing 16-18 hours a day to get areas reopened, protect people's houses and also emergency access. The big challenge for us has been also the continual number of storms we've had over the last few weeks. We just get a route opened and then it gets blocked again. Sadly, some of these routes so will take 6 months, 9 months, maybe a year to get fully reopened.
I've driven about 20 miles towards the coast to the National Trust's Wallington estate. I'm here to meet Paul Hewitt, the countryside manager.
I suppose the scene in front of us is one of devastation, really. There was a wonderful 280-year-old oak tree, and the storm has basically ripped the top half of the tree off. What it's done is a huge weight has actually knocked over a 250-year-old oak tree, and then somewhere under there is an ash tree.
So has the estate been changed forever in a way?
I guess it has. I mean, we do get storms, you know, fairly regularly, and this one, obviously, Arwen, possibly once in a generation, just be really because of the wind direction. I think that's really what did for a lot of these old trees. It did really genuinely feel like, you know, a personal loss. I mean, these trees are effectively irreplaceable for our lifetime. We're going to have to wait 300 years for a tree to get to that stature again, and as human beings, we're quite impatient, but, you know, nature will recover, it will come back, but not in our lifetime.
Paul Hewitt at the National Trust's Wallington Estate in Northumberland. That's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The studio manager is Ilse Laderman, and the producer in Bristol is Heather Simons.